The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, March 16th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The president has put forth ideas for his budget. He's going to cut Meals on Wheels, going to cut the State Department, all grants to the Justice Department, which Mick Mulvaney, director of the OMB, said on Morning Joe, the Morning Joe was out, he said they were only cutting redundant programs at the Department of Justice, programs that don't work or aren't cost effective.
Even though you see a reduction, for example, in the Department of Justice, the amount of money they have to enforce the laws actually go up. We cut a bunch of grant programs. We have grant programs in the Department of Justice, something I didn't even know about till I got into this job.
So it might seem odd and contradictory to support your claim that these programs aren't working, and then you provide as existing evidence the further claim that you've never heard of the programs. It doesn't really quite work, does it? Hey, I just found out they existed, but upon learning about them, I decided they didn't work. Now, I found out they existed too. I kind of was vaguely aware. I didn't know the names of them. But upon investigation, you tell me how popular this will be. Some of the programs that are run under the auspices of the Department of Justice grants include the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office of Sex Offender Sentencing, Monitoring, Apprehending, Registering, and Tracking, which spells SMART and might not be that smart to eliminate, Office of Victims of Crime, and Office on Violence Against Women. They don't make sense. But to be fair, the White House doesn't set the budget. Congress does. And this seems more or less like a garden variety Republican budget. Also, discretionary spending. It's only about a quarter of all expenditures. But once again, like I said, garden variety Republican. Guess what's on the chopping block? CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And of course, the pushback against this is they're picking on Big Bird. Now, if I was a Republican who wanted to cut the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, I would be desperate to switch it away from the icon of Big Bird. I mean, at least if the debate were about they're thinking of cutting Snuffleupagus. I mean, Snuffleupagus, he's not going to go talk to anyone, right? Snuffleupagus gets stitches. Isn't that it? Isn't that why he's not talking? Anyway, from what I understand, after I stopped watching Snuffy, he did go and he did tell. Now, the argument, if you want to be a cutter of PBS or NPR, is that these shows would do well in the marketplace. Look at all the shows on PBS Kids, and then look at all the shows on Nickelodeon Kids. And there are a lot of shows on Nick Kids or Nick Jr. that are just as good or better than the PBS Kids. In fact, I bet all the shows kind of pitch themselves to both networks. However, I do have to say this. As a parent, I've watched both the Nick and the PBS. And then Nick has some good shows, Yo Gabba Gabba, that's a great one. But what PBS doesn't have are those terrible shows, those gateway drug shows to watching Nick Senior shows or Disney Channel shows with a bunch of obnoxious tweens saying the worst sitcom-y jokes in the world. And furthermore, the PBS shows, there are little grace notes within them. Like Super Why is about grammar, that's a good show. Thomas the Train, though English, is about self-empowerment and public transportation. And there's even the show I didn't like that much. I mean, it still exists. My kids have just aged out of the group that watches it. It's called Dinosaur Train. But my friend, who's a geologist, points out that this show never mixes dinosaurs from different periods. That's a little PBS grace note. I thank PBS for that. Of course, the real reason is I worked at NPR. If you cut the budget, they will survive. They could float by in the marketplace. They'll just do it like every other broadcaster does. When it comes time to make budget, they're definitely going to cut a bunch of their foreign bureaus. They're not exactly cost effective. So if you want to cut PBS or if you want to cut NPR, you can make the argument it won't get any worse, but it will definitely get worse. And by the way, the Trump White House wants both PBS and NPR to get worse. On the show today, I spiel about orange populists at home and abroad. But speaking of NPR, we are joined now by Kelly McEvers, whose day job is hosting NPR's All Things Considered. She is here, or actually was there, because we talked at a conference in Anaheim. She was there to talk about, among other things, the new season of Embedded, which is a top podcast and wouldn't be possible without listeners like you.
Hi, Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Oh, I thought those car bombings in El Salvador. I mean, you got what comedy you could out of that.
Yeah. You have to, like, it's contrast. Mm-hmm. You have to have, like, the...
Right. Yeah. If we really were going to go to the dark places, we would have done ATC sad cello theme.
Oh, God. Yeah, exactly. That's a good
I sometimes have that scoring
NPR
the saddest
jokes.
Moment of my
Sorry.
Life.
Nobody wah.
How do you get back from one of those?
Oh, you don't. And yeah. Then, like, you have to read an introduction.
And when I worked at NPR, there was always such sensitivity about, you know, well, we can't put this fun story next to that sad one. I'm like, all we have.
Or we
sad
could. Yeah. Because, yeah, otherwise people are going to get
right. Or, yes, yeah, sad. Yeah. You know what? We need that sad cello buffer. What there should be is sad cello into happy cello.
Oh. Like,
we should do like, or like sad to klezmer.
Cello.
Yeah, we should do a mashup just to take us from, you know, some water in the West story, which I think is the saddest story of all.
Right.
Just because people turn off the radio. And, you know,
so
into
sad.
The Kurds.
We start talking about the drought.
Kelly.
Drought on the radio.
Kelly, I'm loving, or I've loved the embedded podcast, but I've long been a fan of your reporting. I worked at NPR for about 10 years. I don't think we ever met.
I know.
Because you were never in America.
Right.
So
right,
take me through some of your overseas postings, maybe even before NPR.
Before NPR?
Yeah.
Cambodia, Indonesia. I spent a bunch of time in the Caucasus, everybody's mm-hmm. favorite place,
yeah.
North and South Caucasus, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Baghdad, Istanbul, Riyadh, Beirut, and then, you know, traveling to all the great places, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria.
So you go to, say, Beirut, and that is at the height of a war. Are you in Beirut during peaceful times?
Beirut is generally kind of like a peaceful place.
Now
like
it is,
there was
yeah.
like that long war thing in the right. 80s, lasted like 15 years. And so everybody uses Beirut as like an adjective for like yeah. really effed up.
Yeah.
But it's actually kind of cool now. It's like yeah. nice and fun and there's like a lot of drinking.
Well, I mean, people like to contrast it. They say, you know, Beirut was the Paris of the Middle right. East before the war. And then it's like Beirut. But it's like Beirut out there is, you know, it's like something on steroids or it's like
it's
something
like
on
something
crack. It's like a 90s go-to.
Stuff that's been bombed. Yeah. yeah. There's like still buildings that have like big holes in them. I mean, like it's still, I think that's why people kind of like it. There's still something about it that feels like dangerous. And that's why people party like it's 1999.
Yeah, there, bombing but, chic.
Yeah. yeah. But no, so Beirut's pretty great. But it's like an hour and a half away from Damascus. So it's like this place where you can sort of be perched and like, you know, covering and watching the situation in Syria unfold. And like a bunch of times we would sneak over the border into Syria. You could do that from Lebanon, although that was a little sketchy. And so we would fly to Turkey and then sneak in that way with
yeah.
the Syrian rebels.
This is the downside of porous borders is lots of Islamic rebels. The good side is good journalists are allowed in.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, the same corridors.
We'd be going into the border. I would never forget this with these guys with like long beards and like gun-sized boxes. And we're like, what are you going to be up to in there? And like, I'm a doctor. And you're like, yeah, great. So am I.
Yeah. I'm a part of Doctors Without Scruples.
<So totally. laughs>
Medicine sans scrupuleur. But what I think what I meant is, so when you are covering a war zone, you are living sometimes in the war zone, but do you try to live in a peaceful place and just do toe touches into the war zone?
You generally don't live, I mean, with Syria, like, you know, very few journalists, except for the Syrian journalists who are covering conflict, covering their conflict themselves, live there. I mean, a lot of people kind of come in and out. And same, when I was in Baghdad, I was there in 2010. I mean, it wasn't... There wasn't a war in, Iraq in 2010, really. We lived on a regular street in a regular house. You know, the green zone was across the river. It was a pretty fortified situation where American Embassy was and all the Iraqi officials lived. But by and large, it was a fairly normal life. Lots of checkpoints. I mean, we did have armed guards, you know, and towers outside of our house round the clock. But it's not like an active, you know, and you'd hear, okay, so you'd hear explosions a couple times a night. But it was pretty normal. It was totally normal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like Lower Manhattan in the 80s, yeah.
Right. Mortars, yeah.
So you talk about the armed guards. There are two philosophies of security, and one is let's live behind barricades, let's have armaments, and the other is let's kind of go incognito and not make too big a deal. Right. Is there a right way or a wrong way, or does it depend on the specific kind of war zone you're in?
It depends a lot on that. I mean, I think like when we would go into Syria, we would be very low-key. We'd always have a team of just a couple of us. I mean, the great thing about, people are always like, isn't it hard to be a woman in the Middle East? No, it's amazing because, you know, I just put on hijab, speak Arabic, you know, go through a checkpoint with my colleagues who are Syrians, and, you know, we're very much under the radar, and that's definitely the way you want to do it.
I guess
not because
being
you're
a
trying
woman,
to, like,
being a woman who doesn't need anonymity to not get killed, that's the next hurdle.
Yeah,
that kind of woman. Yeah.
So, you know, that's definitely one way to do it, and it's a smart way to do it. It's not that you're trying to conceal the fact that you're a journalist, you're telling people who you are once you get there, but it's sort of the moving around that you don't want to bring attention to yourself. In Baghdad, I mean, we did live on a normal street with, you know, in a normal neighborhood with regular neighbors and stuff, but I mean, everybody knew. Like, if you asked anyone, like, where are the journalists? They'd be right there.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it's going to be. Like, you just have to sort of know that you're going to be, that your location is going to be known and that you're going to be kind of a target.
Right. So. You're the one neighbors who, when someone says a funny anecdote, you're like, and can you spell your surname? Yeah, that is a...
yeah, exactly. What is your age?
So, you did a documentary a few years ago called...
Diary of a Bad Year. I always have the happiest things in my show.
And essentially, like, it's so kind of coming to terms with your being... reporting from war, you're an adrenaline junkie to some extent.
I don't believe in that.
No?
Nope.
You needed the war?
Nope.
You needed war reporting?
Nope.
Okay, then did I listen? Did I listen wrong?
No, I mean, I just...
You examined your own psychology.
This idea that you can be like, I totally did. And like this idea that you can be like addicted to adrenaline, I don't know. I just think that's like a pop... like psychology thing that people throw out there all the time, and I'm just not sure. It wasn't like I was like, dude, I woke up and I'm like, I need my fix, I'm feeling sick, you know, like I gotta get some more. Like, it's just, I don't, for one thing, like I just didn't do a whole lot of combat, you know, like I would just be like, yeah, you guys go over there, and like, I mean, because guess what combat sounds like on the radio? Boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Boom. Like, it's boring. It's actually not that great a radio, except for the day we were on the front line, and this guy was using a karaoke machine to, like, talk to the enemy on the other side. He was like, we're going to bomb you if you bomb us.
Was it a Madonna backing track?
It was his response. No, like, no, he didn't have any music. No, but he was singing it, like, in Arabic. Like, dude, we're going to bomb your ass. And the other guy was like, that was his response. And so that was, like, that was good radio. But usually, like,
it's not. They did that for you. They knew it.
They
knew ATC was there.
Yeah. So, usually it's bad radio, and not that it, like, I don't know, I just, like, you go up to a fighter and you're like, hey, and he's like,
yo,
you know, I mean, there's not, like, they don't actually have a lot to say, like, there's not a lot of stories. So for me, like, the stories are in the towns and the villages and, like, that have changed hands, and, like, how are you, like, getting electricity, and, like, who's taking care of the food, and, like, how did you get here, and, like, why do you believe in this, and, like, all, you know, that to me is the interesting stuff. So yeah, was I, like, addicted to that in some way? Yes, but did it have to do with some, like, chemical thing happening in my brain that felt like drugs. I don't know. I don't buy it.
Okay, so when after you come back from a reporting gig where the stakes are life and death, does reporting on what should be, you know, an important, say, domestic story,
going to the city council meeting feels kind of boring.
Right. But even important stories, a charter school story, things that are important to people that should be well reported, can you just not get it up to report on that?
I thought that was going to be a problem, and then I came back to America and I was like, whoa, America kind of messed up. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It was like, yeah, kind of some problems here.
And
you
not
know?
That dissimilar. I remember when I think it was Falwell died, and I was saying to myself, how come the phrase radical cleric isn't making its way into all the newscasts?
Exactly. Muqtada El-Sadr.
Yeah.
Jerry Falwell.
Are we so different from Sunni and Shia? At least those people can articulate what their differences
are.
You know,
it's
at
like
least
it was 1,400 years ago. Here's the problem. Like it's
they follow Ali. At least it's written down somewhere.
I know, as opposed to this vague
sense of grievance. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are reporters who we know who I felt in the war zone were great because they were around a chaotic situation, a crazy situation, and they really calmed things down. Mm-hmm. The same reporter that who I'm thinking of came to America and was like told to report on a Halloween store, and what you're supposed to do is make that really exciting, and she couldn't do that.
Yeah,
you know, I maybe it's just a skill set, maybe it's
maybe
a result
that's
of being
an editor's
in the
problem. Like,
that's
why would you assign that person a Halloween store? Like, that's really like, let's think about this a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, like I came back and they were like, go to the border. You know, I mean, they were like,
oh yeah, do something.
You know,
similar.
They knew what they were, what they had, they were dealing with. They were like, that animal's going to go crazy in the cage. Go let her out. You know, like a couple of times.
I want to ask you about Embedded, but I want to ask you this very existential question. Mm-hmm. Do you think good foreign reporting actually leads to good policies for a country?
Wow. I mean, I'm going to have to say no, because I think we did some pretty good stuff on Syria, and nothing happened. Like, I'm not saying we should have done this, we should have done that. Like, I'm not saying there was a clear, good answer in Syria, but I'm also saying that we have an administration that did nothing. That, I mean, I would go to these conferences where the Syrian opposition, whatever that means, would get together trying to hammer out something, and you'd have people from the State Department, good Americans working really hard, and they're like, we can't get the White House on the phone. They won't pick up our calls. They do not want this. They got elected on the idea that the Iraq war was a mistake. It's in the rearview mirror. It's over. They want nothing to do with this. And again, I don't have an answer for what they should have done, but I feel like doing nothing was not the response.
I'm going to take a policy digression and ask you about that. It would seem with this horrible humanitarian catastrophe with the most refugees since World War II that whatever we did do, we shouldn't have done. Yet you can make the analogy. It's like the football team who's 4th-and-1 and they decide to run and they get stuffed. And so everyone will then say, well, you should have passed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't prove that you should have passed. And in fact, passing might have led to an interesting or something worse.
Yeah.
But the point is, do you believe that the evidence, the best argument for having done something can't just be that things are terrible now?
No.
You have to be able to say that whatever the solution was, boots on the ground, humanitarian corridors, you know, air support, would have been better.
No-fly zones, right. Arming the rebels, training the rebels, helping them take them out.
Finding the rebels, vetting the rebels.
Knowing who they are, all five of them,
So I'm not sure that it would have worked
better. No, I'm basing this on what I saw in 2011, 2012 when I was there, you know, like in the place, looking at and talking to the people. And also just like there is a thing called the loss of human life and the responsibility to protect, a thing that we did in the Balkans, a thing we've done in other places, a thing that we haven't done in some places. And you have to think about that in some way. I mean, what's, you know, Samantha Power? Like, where are you? Like, what do you think about all this?
Well, from what I understand, a lot of the women in the administration wanted to intervene for humanitarian purposes. And a lot of the men maybe too well learned the lesson of the last war, which is don't involve U.S. troops.
And look at Libya. Yeah. I mean, not okay.
Like, the Middle East is an area where in Libya we did intervene and we fucked up. In Egypt, we lightly intervened and we fucked up. In Syria, we didn't intervene and we fucked up. In the Iraq war, that was
our
total...
the biggest fuck up of all time.
Yes.
Yeah, so
Tunisia's the only thing that went well.
In the Arab Spring, it's possible that it is the only one that will end with a happy ending.
Okay, so Embedded comes along, or you come back to NPR. And, well, how's it go? They say, we want you to host ATC, and you said only if I get to do some radio documentaries?
Something like that.
Okay. So you have a little leverage. And was it the case that, so if people don't know, during Morning Edition or All Things Considered, pretty much the biggest chunk is like almost an 8-minute chunk?
Yeah, we have an 11-minute segment in ATC.
Eleven whole minutes
of radio.
Hey, listen, if we're delving deep into the, Kurds, Sunni Shiite thing, maybe 11 minutes is enough to tell you.
Terrible 11 minutes. Yeah.
So you just wanted to go longer?
Yeah. No. I wanted to be in this world of podcasts where you like get to tell stories in a totally different way, and you like get to be a person, and you like get to talk about stuff, and like you're talking to your friends, and
that's right. So this,
like, do this kind of reporting, but do it in a, I mean, like, what did we all learn from serials? Like, oh, look, I mean, in addition to like whodunit crack, like every people like journalism, like they're cool with that. Mm-hmm. They'll go along for the ride. Like if you're gonna go discover a thing, they'll come with you if they trust you and they know that you're not perfect and you fuck up sometimes, and you know you're no longer this anchor who's just gonna tell you how it is. And I don't know, just see what happens. Like that seems to be a form of doing this thing that we've been doing for decades and decades that was interesting and new. And like, you can go on a journey in 4 minutes. You can take people on. I mean, you can make a piece of theater in 4 or 5 minutes that has a beginning, a middle, and end, and has a kind of question that people want to answer. And I mean, I think there's a lot you can do. It's not just about length, right? It's not just that it's better, that longer is better. I mean, I think that's a danger. You know, I think a journalist who wants their stories to be really long can like get really flabby. I think that's a big danger with podcasts. I think you have to try really hard, you know, not to be too indulgent.
So my last question is this. I think you wanted to get into the podcast form. The podcast form, podcasting can be a great boon to foreign reporting. And yet at the same time, you could also make the argument that, you know, one of the selling points of podcasting is telling these big old legacy media companies that we could be nimbler and then we could be looser. And I think some of those things are actually the antithesis of foreign reporting. Like, you need a lot of resources to do foreign reporting.
Yeah.
And if the lesson of podcasting is we could
cheap
do it on
nimble.
The, yeah, we could do it on the cheap. And that we could do it with maybe the people without, you don't need 15 years of experience to do it. I don't think that's necessarily true with the best foreign reporting.
No, right.
Well, it's like resources intensive undertaking.
I mean, the thing about embedded is not all foreign reporting for sure. It's just like, again, when they know they need to let the animal out of the cage, they're like, go do this thing. You go do Ebola because we know you'll do that. And like, go El Salvador. So I was already on assignment in El Salvador for like some other thing. And this is classic NPR, right? Somebody's paying for it out of their budget.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing it for them. And then like, it was literally our last day in El Salvador. We had finished this reporting assignment that we were on for ATC.
What was the ATC?
It was about the gang violence.
Okay.
But it was this bigger project that was funded by the Global Health Unit.
Okay.
It was about how women are being affected by the gang violence, part of this 15 girls thing. Anyway, whatever. We were there for like 10 days. We did tons of reporting. I was like sick as a dog. There was this weird disease going around called chikungunya. I was convinced that I had chikungunya, which I didn't, but I was really sick. And I was laying in my hotel room, and it was like supposed to fly out the next day, and the gals that I'm working with who are going to be here on stage, they're here, come knocking on my door, and they're like, you got to come. They're executing bus drivers. And I was like, holy shit. And I just was like, all right. And I turned the tape recorder on. I'm like, next 24 hours, whatever happens, embedded, go. So, I mean, yes, it took a lot of resources to get us there and to like do the kind of reporting that we were doing for this other thing. But then it was just like, whoa, we got 24 hours here. Wherever this crazy thing goes, let's just see what happens. And that was an episode. So that was kind of nimble, I would say, like in some ways. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't take a ton, you know, sometimes to just do the kind of reporting that you can then. And then that became a pretty suspenseful, like 30 minutes, you know, whatever, however that thing played out, I think was kind of a interesting story that you wouldn't have been able to do on a regular show.
Kelly McEvers, she survived the chikungunya by proxy.
Right, yeah.
And she's ridden with the Cossacks. Kelly McEvers, embedded, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Populism. It's sweeping the Brits, the Americans, the French, but the Dutch? Not so much. The populist wave was Amsterdammed, Rotterdammed. They held firm against the twerp of Antwerp, Geert Wilders. Lots of people are described as the Trump of Duterte is the Trump of the Philippines. Kevin O'Leary is the Trump of Canada. But Geert Wilders really is the Trump of the Netherlands. For one, he's orange. He's an orange-hued man, which in Holland is in and of itself a statement of nationalism. For another, his hair makes Trump's hair look like Mike Brady's hair. Geert has way more than Trump hair. He has Milo Yiannopoulos hair. But the Wilder party underperformed in national elections. They're the PVV, which stands for Party for Freedom. From Moroccans, that part's implied. The PVV did gain 5 seats, but it was projected to do much better, at least twice as well. There will be no Geert Wilders era, but the Dutch, because they have a parliamentary system and a general sense of decency, were never going to align their parties to give him the prime ministership anyway. But if Wilders will go back to wandering the wilderness of the backbenches of the Tweed Kamer, a question does remain. How do you pronounce Geert? I think I've been doing it wrong, because today on the BBC, I heard from a Politico Europe editor named Naomi O'Leary saying Geert this way. And then the announcer of the same BBC show, Jackie Leonard, said it this way. But I thought it would be best, again, within the same broadcast, to go with the pronunciation of an actual Dutchman. This is a member of parliament from the governing Liberal Party, Anton Broeker. So it's more like a Geert. They really get the hissing of the Geert. Love might not Trump hate, but in the Netherlands, they hate on Geert. But what of our American version of Trump, which is to say Trump? He told an enthusiastic crowd of Trump supporters in Nashville that he would prefer the old version of his anti-immigration executive order. See, this was after a federal judge in Hawaii suspended the new executive order based mostly on intemperate words that Trump spoke before enthusiastic crowds. I just imagine at this Nashville event, some stenographer hired by the ACLU in the corner. Do go on, Mr. President. But let's remember who Trump is and how he got here. Trump first demonstrated his political judgment by advancing ideas about the immigration status of a president from Hawaii. Now we get a Hawaiian judge forcing President Trump's ideas over immigration into retreat. That's the kind of symmetry. But what of the ongoing investigation into wiretapping, quote unquote wiretapping? And I put it in quotes, unquote, because nobody ever talks about the quotes.
And nobody ever talks about the fact that it was in quotes, but that's a very important thing.
You know, there are lots of things nobody ever talks about.
Hillary cheating on the debates, which, by the way, nobody mentions. Nobody mentions that Hillary received the questions to the debates.
There was also,
like, lots of things are done with uranium, including some bad things. Nobody talks about that.
And then this thing that nobody ever talks about.
And nobody ever mentions North Korea, where you have this maniac sitting there, and he actually has nuclear weapons.
No one ever talks about that. That was one claim that Trump made to Tucker Carlson of Fox, excusing or explaining his charge of being wiretapped. That one or two of his four tweets where he alleged wiretapping, he did put wiretapping in quotes. Though there were two other tweets where he didn't put wiretapping in quotes. And there was also a tweet where he spelled tap wrong. T-A-P-P, he spelled it. Well, maybe what he was really saying was that Obama performed transabdominal preperitoneal hernia surgery on him, tap surgery along with TEP surgery, two of the most popular hernia surgeries. And nobody is talking about that. Maybe he meant that Obama didn't wiretap him. Maybe he was saying that Obama taped The Wire. Obama loves the David Simon HBO show The Wire. And Trump just wanted to watch Omar and Bubbles. But now, where's the tape? Thanks, Obama. So those were some of the words that Trump formed in his mouth that he hoped some people would buy as an excuse to overlook the fact that he literally alleged that the past president wiretapped him. Trump also brought into play a TV show he once saw, and it wasn't The Wire. He told Tucker Carlson it was a Fox show.
I've been reading about things. I read in, I think it was January 20th, a New York Times article where they were talking about wiretapping. There was an article, I think they used that exact term. I read other things. I watched your friend Brett Baer the day previous where he was talking about certain very complex sets of things happening and wiretapping.
Okay, let's say Obama did tap Trump's phone. And when I say Obama tapped him, I mean literally. There's Obama sitting there up on the wire like Lester or Presbyluski before he became a teacher. And Obama is listening intently. And he hears Trump say certain word combos like where he was talking about certain very complex sets of things happening. Obama must be thinking, all right, something's going down. This is clearly code. This is not regular human speech. Certain sets of complex things. Did you know that Steve Bannon's wife was busted for trying to sneak a cell phone into a prison? And the code word was Pop-Tart. Do you want delivery of the Pop-Tart? Is it okay if it's a clamshell Pop-Tart? Do you need a 4G Pop-Tart? But these things, these complex things, that sounds really nefarious. And indeed it is. But I have the best explanation for what's going on. Trump, he is so convinced of his powers to convince that he just figures he only has to pronounce a couple of syllables and his people will buy it. So he said Brett Baer, but maybe he was thinking Breitbart. If you say Breitbart and Brett Baer, they sound kind of similar. The same kind of people are going to be convinced. And this whole tactic, it explains a lot of answers he's going to have to give. What about your infrastructure plan, Mr. President? Build bridge. Well, how do we pay it? By brick. Well, what about healthcare? Bad bill. What about the people who can't afford it? By bread. Okay, he's going into the burbling thing. Mr. President, should we call Melania? Brat bride. Well, who should we call? Breitbart, bro. Breitbart? Oh, you want to call Milo? No. Bad bot, big brain. Breitbart, bro. Oh, Bannon. You want us to call Steve Bannon. Is that right? Breitbart. There you go again, Mr. President. More 12-dimensional chess. Bye. And that's it for today's show. After the war, Mary Wilson just couldn't get that into Harrisburg zoning proposals. After the war, just producer Chris Berube lost his taste for Medicine Hat hunting license disputes. Pre-conflict, Steve Lickteig was executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Post-conflict, he's just been listening to the XX Gabfest on a continuous loop on half speed. After Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, saw some things overseas, meringue never tasted quite the same again. The gist, we hear the next season of the podcast Startup will be following around the podcast Embedded after they lose CPB funding. The resulting podcast, Indebted, is set to debut at number 2 on iTunes, unless someone finds Richard Simmons. Oomperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening. I know you listen to podcasts. I can prove it. You just heard me say that. And unless you're actually in the room with me, get out of here, Dave. Unless you're Dave. you know how to listen to podcasts. Now, I'm sure you want to spread the joy of podcasts, or maybe you're the kind of person who only likes the bands that no one else likes, and then when they book big clubs, they're like, oh, I used to like them on their first album. We're still in the first album phase of this media, but we do have to grow it, because remember, that band that you wanted to keep to yourself, they could break up due to lack of interest. So this is where the Tripod campaign comes in. All this month, you want to find a friend, relative, a curious stranger. Okay, that could be fraught. And show them how to try podcasts. Hello, are you a stranger? You are a curious stranger. Let me show you my iPhone now. Okay, just take it, you know, pump the brakes on curious stranger a little. But get this person who you think or suspect might like podcasts. And then share your story on Twitter with the hashtag Tripod. Okay, so you do whatever you can to get a new be into podcasting, but then afterwards you tweet about it and you do TRY pod, hashtag TRY pod. Together we could delete podcast unawareness.